We're also going to take a deeper dive into much of the material, so I think you will find, again, whether you've heard it for the first or second time, that there's a lot here to absorb. So just a few housekeeping details. First, we're going to go through the entire presentation, and then we will address your questions. Therefore, your phones will be muted, so we cannot hear you. We do encourage you to write questions that you think of as we go along in that chat box on the lower left of your screen, where you'll see right now that there's a message there from Sarah and myself to you, telling you all to make sure that you phone in. It's in that box that you can add other questions. We'll keep a running tally of those, and we will get to as many of them as we can. We also want you to know that we're going to circulate the toolkit at the end of this week to the email addresses that we have from the registration, so hopefully you have registered if you are interested in getting a copy. So I want to get started and to say that the toolkit is a wonderful partnership between God's Love We Deliver and the Center for Health Law and Policy Innovation at Harvard. And many of the opportunities that are addressed in the toolkit are, are for more customized food and nutrition services like home-delivered meals that have been individually tailored for clients' unique medical circumstances or for nutritious congregate meals for populations in group care settings. So in large measure, the programs that offer medically tailored food and nutrition services, as you will see in this pyramid graphic, are the ones that probably have most opportunities in the world of healthcare reform as it currently stands. And that when we say medically tailored, we mean food that is designed by a registered dietitian nutritionist in collaboration with a chef for individuals in their program, or the populations of individuals in their programs. And the meals are designed to improve the health and well-being of people living with severe and chronic illness. So you'll see on the left there, two of those bars are around prevention and two are around treatment. In general, it's the treatment pieces that the toolkit addresses more than the prevention, although this is, as it says in the title, an evolving definition. And therefore, when you think about your program, if you are in the prevention categories, there are probably going to be, over time, more and more opportunities for you as well. So the advocacy tools are applicable no matter where you are in this pyramid, but many of the opportunities that we're going to review really do address the treatment side of the of dealing with the medically tailored interventions. So I just want to take a moment to talk about why are we spending so much time on advocacy and advocacy toolkit and really focusing on healthcare opportunities through the lens of advocacy. And I think many of us have been dealing with the fact that for food and nutrition programs, funding streams continue to shrink. There's not that much national funding, and certainly not very much state and local fundings for many of our programs. So programs have to kind of accept the inevitable decline that may come in their services as funding shrinks, or they can mobilize and advocate for policies that actually support the work that you're doing and your clients' overall health. Of course, in that context, many programs have chosen the second opportunity, which is to mobilize and advocate, and are looking at healthcare initiatives within the changing landscape of Medicaid, Medicare, duly eligible services, private insurance, and innovation programs that are being piloted in so many states. And it is those that we are really going to be looking at through this webinar, the first half of this webinar, and then the second half on taking those activities and turning them into action. So I will have great pleasure of introducing one of our great colleagues at one of our, from the God's Love perspective, but much more broadly, the Food and Nutrition Services perspective, to introduce Sarah Downer. Sarah is from the Center for Health Law and Policy Innovation at Harvard Law School, and she is a clinical instructor at the law school. So with that, I turn it over to Sarah.
Great. Thank you, Karen, for the introduction. So the advocacy toolkit that we've done in partnership with God's Love is really, it has two big main goals. And the first is to give everybody here in a really digestible format some of the very technical information that you might want about our current healthcare landscape so that you can identify the opportunities that are out there for your organization and so that you can expand or find funding for services. And the second is really to be able to grab those opportunities and to transform the familiarity that you're going to be building with all of this jargon into new sustainable funding streams and maybe expand your client base. So I'm going to be covering the first part, the delivering the information that you need to navigate this healthcare landscape. So this is pretty technical stuff. You're going to have to bear with me, but we all need to know some fundamentals before Karen's going to come back, jump in, and really help you understand how you're going to spring into action and make these systems work for you, because you are all providers of very valuable food interventions. So today I'm going to be covering the ins and outs of current and potential insurance coverage of food interventions, but specifically I'm really going to be looking at opportunities that currently exist for reimbursement of medically tailored meals. So as Karen noted, right, there's a broad spectrum of food interventions that could fall under a food as medicine umbrella. And we as a community are talking and thinking about how to unite many levels of those interventions into healthcare. But, however, the fact is that the current reimbursement and integration opportunities for food and nutrition services are really largely for coverage of meals. And so that's what we're going to be focusing on today. So given that, we're going to take first a look at our public insurance programs, an overview of Medicaid first and then Medicare and what they cover. And these are large and really complex programs. And I think everyone, including us at the Center for Health Law and Policy, there always seems to be something more to learn about the way that these programs operate. So I'm going to describe the way they're structured and operate today as it relates to coverage of food and nutrition services. And this is going to be review for some of you, but it really helps to build familiarity with these terms so that we can get more comfortable with going after the opportunities where they exist. So the healthcare landscape, especially in the aftermath of the Affordable Care Act, or the ACA as I'll refer to it from here on out, is changing rapidly. Medicare and Medicaid are changing in terms of their payment and funding structures, and the trend is really away from fee-for-service, where the program pays, for example, per provider visit or per test performed. And they're looking now at funding models like bundled payments, and they're looking to incorporate financial incentives for giving quality care while increasing financial efficiency. And our position, of course, is that food as medicine is a service that both improves outcomes and reduces costs, because it decreases hospitalizations, it increases the ability for folks to live independently. So we think that provision of medically tailored meals is a very well-positioned service to become a highly valued part of these new holistic models of care that are rapidly developing. So let's start by looking at Medicaid. So Medicaid is our healthcare safety net. It's a federal and state-funded health insurance program for certain categories of low-income folks. So in our current post-ACA healthcare landscape, the Medicaid population is broken into two categories, which I'm going to call traditional and expansion. And traditional Medicaid really refers to the system of eligibility criteria and benefits that were available to Medicaid recipients before the Affordable Care Act gave states the option to expand their Medicaid programs. So before the ACA, to qualify for traditional Medicaid, beneficiaries had to be not only low income, but also had to fall into certain categories, such as children or parents. And so under this system, these categorically needy beneficiaries received a certain package of benefits, a combination of what had to be covered according to the federal government, and then some other optional benefits that states could choose to cover. By contrast, the expansion population consists of individuals who became eligible for Medicaid based upon the Affordable Care Act's option to expand Medicaid program to all individuals up to 133% FPL. So these beneficiaries receive what is known as an alternative benefits package, which must contain certain federally mandated benefits like preventive care and chronic disease management. And a lot of states have chosen to align their traditional package and their alternative benefits packages, but it's important to be aware that there are both because differences can exist between what is covered for these two populations. So here's a nice graphic from the Kaiser Family Foundation showing the current status of Medicaid expansion across the country, and I included this because it'll be easy for you to look for your state here and see whether your state has expanded Medicaid coverage in those states in dark blue or has declined to do so at this time. So eligibility for Medicaid can really vary from state to state. So in an expansion state like Massachusetts, all folks up to 138% of the federal poverty level will be covered by Medicaid or are eligible to be covered by Medicaid. In Alabama, by contrast, there's no coverage at all for low-income childless adults. And Medicaid generally pays for services it covers in one of two ways. Traditionally, it was a fee-for-service payment model, but many states now are moving towards a managed care organization model, or MCO. And MCOs are private insurers that pay for, that where Medicaid pays them a fixed price per member per month, or PMPM, to cover all of the Medicaid services that those recipients are eligible for. So meals are not a covered benefit in traditional mainstream Medicaid. This doesn't mean that they could never be, but they're not at this point. So when we're thinking about current coverage opportunities in Medicaid, we're going to look at what's happening through what are called waivers. And states apply to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, or CMS, to waive certain Medicaid requirements. So Medicaid requires, for example, that states offer all the benefits to the Medicaid beneficiaries within them statewide. And so states can apply to waive some of these requirements so that they can offer services to specific populations within Medicaid. This is how they try out administering new benefits so that they can try to improve the care that they're giving to Medicaid recipients and reduce the cost at the same time. Waivers are temporary, but states can continue to renew them. So they typically last between a 3 and 5 year period, and all waivers have to be approved by CMS. And within these waiver programs, provision of home-delivered meals has been a feature for some time now. And you can take a look at the website on the slide. You can go there and you can search the different waivers and see whether your state has them and also what they include. So, for example, we can look at what's called the Home and Community-Based Services Waiver. This is a 1915C waiver because it's Section 1915C of the Social Security Act that describes it. A number of states, like Maryland, Massachusetts, among others, have used this waiver to provide access to home-delivered meals. Because what they're used for is they're used to support in-home services to help states avoid institutionalizing individuals who would otherwise need to be in a nursing home or other acute care facility. So home-delivered meals have been covered as a part of these waivers. And so if you're eligible, if you're in this eligible population, so you're 60 or older, you meet certain financial criteria, and you require a certain level of nursing facility care, you might be able to receive meals through a 1915C waiver through Medicaid. So if your state has one of these waivers, Medicaid may be authorized to cover meals for this population, and it's an opportunity for you as a meal program to contract with the state Medicaid program to provide this service. Another waiver program is the Medicaid 1115 demonstration waiver. And this waiver allows states very broad flexibility to experiment with expanding eligibility, to implement care delivery models that are new, to cover different benefits. And states can use these waivers to offer home-delivered meals as part of a benefits package for certain individuals. So they could, for example, apply for a waiver to expand coverage to individuals with certain chronic illnesses or other populations as well. And they can frame this waiver as a way for the state to test the efficacy of providing meal services to certain populations, so in order to decrease costs and improve health outcomes. And again, to determine whether your state currently has any of these waivers, you can go to that website and you can search by state, you can search by waiver to figure out what your state offers at this time. And then shifting away from Medicaid, let's think a little bit about Medicare. So Medicare is our federal health insurance program for people who are over 65, largely. It's broken into four parts. So Part A, hospital insurance, Part B, medical insurance, Part C, Medicare Advantage. So that's where private insurers are offering MCO plans, like Blue Cross might offer a plan to provide all of the Medicare benefits to Medicare beneficiaries. And then it has Part D, prescription drug coverage. So unlike Medicaid, which is a state and federal partnership, Medicare is really a completely federal program, so the benefits are more consistent, and the eligibility requirements are more consistent across states. And in looking at coverage of meals within Medicare, we're going to really look at Medicare Part C. So Medicare Part C is, again, the Medicare Advantage program. So under Medicare Part C, the plans, meaning the insurers, Blue Cross, Humana, who's ever providing these Medicare Advantage plans, can choose. So this is really at the insurer's discretion to cover meals in some specific circumstances or offer them as a supplemental benefit that plan enrollees could receive by paying a higher premium. So Medicare Advantage plans can offer a broader array of food and nutrition services than standard Medicare if, for example, such a service is needed due to illness and offered for a short duration after a hospitalization or surgery or as part of a lifestyle transition program. So for someone who's trying to change their diet in conjunction with physician instructions, they could receive a temporary period of meals. And you can follow the link that's here on the slide to learn more about the Medicare Advantage plans that are offered within your state and what kind of benefits they may include. And then within Medicare Advantage, there are Medicare special needs plans. And these are Medicare plans that are specifically designed to target individuals with special needs. And we're going to focus here on dual eligible special needs plans. And so these plans are designed for folks that are going to be eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. So they have a high level of medical needs. These are senior populations who have some level of disability. And for these plans, insurers can choose to provide home delivered meal services at no additional cost to the people who are enrolled, and they don't have that time restriction that are placed on those regular Medicare Advantage plans. So they could provide meals on a long-term, not just a temporary basis. And if there's a special needs plan offered in your service area, there can be an opportunity to contract with that plan to provide meal services. I also want to briefly mention another two opportunities for integrating services into care programs that are aimed, again, at this dual eligible population. So the first is PACE, the Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly, where nonprofit agencies provide the services to folks who are eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. They provide all the services that Medicare would normally cover, and then they can include additional services like home-delivered meals. So you could see if your state has a PACE program, and then try to contract with that PACE program to provide meals to the folks that are on there, that are enrolled in the PACE program. But they're not offered in every state. And this is a good opportunity to just step back and say, we really need to be advocating for broader accessibility to meal services in Medicare, because PACE, Medicare Part C, Medicare Special Needs Plans, they're not available in all parts of the country to all Medicare beneficiaries. So the meals that are covered by them are also optional. They're not required. And so we can really do better for everyone on Medicare by working to broaden inclusion of medically tailored meals into services for everyone who's eligible for Medicare. And then to mention another dual-eligible project, there are dual-eligible demonstration projects going on in a lot of states. Again, projects to improve care and lower costs for dual-eligibles. And then these, as these demonstration projects evolve, many states with participating plans have the flexibility to offer a really broad range of food interventions. For example, in Massachusetts, the dual-eligible demonstration project is called OneCare, and it's currently contracting with a medically tailored meal provider here in Massachusetts, Community Servings, to provide medically tailored meals for beneficiaries in the program. And as I said up front, both public and private payers are really looking to improve outcomes and cut costs. And public insurance is doing this by experimenting with a lot of new healthcare delivery models. And in particular, states can apply to participate in an innovation model that's developed by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, known as CMMI. And the CMMI program allows states to design and experiment with brand new models of care aimed at certain populations or certain health conditions, depending on the focus of the particular innovation model. And these can include food and other nutrition-related services. They don't have to, but they can. So it's worth keeping an eye on new rounds of funding awards offered by CMMI so that your organization knows if there's an opportunity to get involved. And you can get involved by either shaping what your state application will look like, so we want it to include meal services, or in contracting with the state if they're participating in a demonstration that could include your services. And if you're a program on this webinar that doesn't currently offer medically tailored meals, as Karen was talking about, this is an opportunity for you still to be more, become more integrated into the healthcare landscape, because there's no sort of limit on what different models could be proposed or what different models could be funded. So it can include a wide variety of food and nutrition services. And there's a recently announced model, so this is very exciting, announced in September, that could offer opportunities for coverage of meals and other food interventions. And this is specifically for Medicare Advantage plans. So this is going to happen in 7 states, Arizona, Indiana, Iowa, Massachusetts, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee. And the idea is that it's going to experiment with cutting cost sharing and providing supplementary benefits. And those supplementary benefits explicitly in this model can include food and nutrition services. So this is called the value-based insurance design model. And it's targeted at folks within these states that have these diagnoses. So you can take a look at this, and then you'll want to take a look at the call for proposals and think about how your organization might be involved in trying to help your state think through what it's going to look like. And many of you have heard about accountable care organizations, or ACOs. So again, the trend in healthcare is really toward new funding models. And you've seen this through some of the waiver programs and demonstration projects that we've talked about. So another relatively recent healthcare delivery model that was created post-ACA is accountable care organizations. So you can have an ACO in Medicare, you can have it in Medicaid, you can have it in the private insurance realm. And what it does is it lets providers and payers and a whole host of healthcare landscape folks get together to have a direct stake in providing costs at the quality care at the lowest cost. So they're going to have a direct stake in being able to save costs, and they're going to also have some risk if they exceed the costs that would normally be involved in providing care to the patients they serve. And there's a lot of flexibility around how accountable care organizations spend their savings or capitated payments. So this can create an opportunity for food and nutrition services to contract with these folks that are part of ACOs. And then finally, let's think about private insurance. So just as public insurance programs are looking to improve outcomes and lower costs, private payers are trying to do the exact same thing. And some of the new funding models that are being adopted or piloted in the private sphere, or in the public sphere rather, are being piloted in the private sphere as well. And private insurers really have even more flexibility to respond quickly and adopt innovative services if they can demonstrate that they meet the end goals of good outcomes and financial efficiency, which is what we think medically tailored meals do. So private insurance is a great place to find new opportunities for coverage of services. But there are no federal requirements for covering nutritional services in private insurance like home-delivered meals. So to the extent that if you have a service, such as medically tailored meals, you can demonstrate improved health outcomes and reduce costs, then you're going to be in a good position to advocate for inclusion of such services in private insurance. And Karen's really going to come back and talk about the importance of messaging around what the integration of food and nutrition services can do for an insurer. So where are the next opportunities going to come from? A lot of the ability to seize current opportunities and then stay nimble as an organization and ready to jump on new opportunities is just knowing the trends and thinking about where they're leading us. So as Karen will talk about, you're going to want to stay aware of what the new pilot delivery models are, what their goals are, what services they will or could include, and you're going to want to keep thinking about how to demonstrate the impact of your services to all types of payers. So this is a really brief overview of some current and future opportunities for the coverage of medically tailored meals in healthcare. And for some of you, this was a review and hopefully another opportunity to build the confidence that comes with knowing this terminology and being really conversant with these big, complex programs. And for others, this could be completely new. And so if that's the case and you really want to do a deep dive into this material, you can take a look at our research white paper on these topics. So the link is here. And then for those of you who don't provide meals but provide other kinds of food interventions, we've also done another paper on food as a preventive service, and we will send a link also to that after the webinar is over. So thank you so much for listening to me. I'm hoping you'll ask lots of questions on these topics in the Q&A. But now that we've really laid out some of these opportunities, Karen's going to come back, and she's going to take us through the steps that an organization will need to take to turn these opportunities for more funding and expanding services into a reality on the ground.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I really appreciate you laying all of that out. I, again, want to reinforce that we know it's very complicated. Some of us who have been studying this, I don't know, it feels like 50 or 100 times, learn something new every single time we listen again. So thank you very much, Sarah. So I'm going to turn to the more nuts and bolts, which is developing how we go about developing an advocacy plan. And this, again, is all going to be outlined in the toolkit, which we will send to you. We want to remind everybody that you can send us questions. A few of you have already. We will get to them at the end of both presentations because some of those questions may get answered as we go along, and if not, we'll come back to it. So I want to start with a kind of a different presentation of that pyramid that you saw at the beginning. This one is a little bit more focused on different kinds of delivery services for food and nutrition. And that is to look at the continuum of care for FNS, or food and nutrition services. So we're going in terms of from prevention to treatment, as that triangle did, but also going from the bottom up toward the top bottom left to the top right on the kinds of services that are needed based on the intensity of illness and the symptoms of the clients that you are working with. And what's really important before you start to develop your advocacy plan is that you figure out where on this continuum you actually lie, on what level of intensity of illness and symptoms your clients experience, how much you tailor or don't tailor your program, not only according to good nutrition standards, but also according to the individual circumstances of your clients. And when you compare your organization and its goals and its client base to the requirements of available opportunities, you will be able to identify which of those you want to pursue. And that will become important in a moment. I'll come back to that. Similarly, on the challenges side, you need to do some policy research and some on-the-ground exploration in terms of your local community and or state to figure out what, if any, barriers exist that might be in your way of establishing reimbursement contracts. And they can be at any number of different points. One can be at the state level, where there may be a lack of Medicaid expansion. Another may be at the insurer level, where they may not cover food and nutrition services. And another may actually be in your own backyard, which is at your own provider level, where you may not have the practices in place and to be able to actually meet the requirements of a contract. So once you understand all of this, both the external environment and your own internal environment, you can get started on doing your advocacy plan. The overall steps in the plan are first to determine what it is you want to advocate for, who then are your best targets, well, who are the key players that who you need to influence, and how who's in your coalition to help you to do that, and ultimately then which actions you're going to take to get to your goals. So that's a big graphic, and we're going to sort of take that apart in pieces through the rest of this presentation, but it will cover those five steps just to give you a sense of the landscape of where we're headed. So the first is to determine your advocacy ask. And you really have to think about, and I've already seen in a couple of questions that have come through that people are asking about this. So you need to think about whether you are going to seize an opportunity that already exists, and I'm going to say largely in your state, because healthcare reform has become a state-by-state activity. It would be a lot easier for all of us if it were national and we were all in the same playing field, but we're not. Every state is a little bit different. And in some cases, cities are even different from their states. So I say that for you to think about that. So you need to figure out if there's an opportunity that currently exists, like Sarah talked earlier about 1115 waivers. So for instance, at God's Love We Deliver, we have a number of contracts that are in place because New York State has an 1115 waiver. So our advocacy can be around something that exists. You can also see that you might want to expand existing opportunities. So for instance, again, I'll use our own experience. We have these 1115 waivers, so we have contracts with managed care companies that we have been able to expand now to cover dually eligible populations. So we took something that was already there, and then we have used that as a base to show our efficacy to be able to expand that opportunity. And then the third is to create brand new opportunities where you may want to help your state to include FNS in a new waiver, or you may want to see if you can lobby to get Medicaid expansion in, or to advocate for Medicaid expansion in your state. There are a number of different new opportunities that you might be able to create based on where your state is today. So figuring all of this out requires a fair amount of research about the landscape in which you are currently thinking about your advocacy plan. You need to look at some of those websites that Sarah had talked about earlier, but you need to remember that this is work that you're not going to do once and say that it's done. You're going to need to always be on the lookout for how things are changing in your state, because in the world of healthcare reform, there are new things coming all the time, and there are new opportunities that present themselves, and you don't want to miss them. So some of the techniques to do that research, and again, I remind you all, we will be sending this to you, so you don't have to worry about whatever, taking pictures with your camera. So you need to look at websites, and again, we will have a list of them or some of them at least, in the toolkit. There are websites that track policy. Sarah said earlier something about what she put up the map from the Kaiser Foundation. That's an example of a policy organization that actually tracks and prints these things up on the web, which is really helpful to all of us. You can consult with other organizations like lawyers' organizations, other associations of not-for-profits. You can think about, which a number of food and nutrition providers have done quite successfully, recruiting board members to be on to serve on their boards, but who represent in their real day jobs either healthcare or insurance companies or hospitals. And one sort of rule of thumb is as you're thinking about all of these different opportunities, whether it's Medicaid, Medicare, whatever, you can ask yourself the questions that are on the right of the screen. Does my state have any fill-in-the-blank Medicaid, let's say, program that covers home-delivered meals? If yes, which beneficiaries are eligible to receive services? Are there specific requirements of those services? Which agency or organization is responsible for deciding which providers will provide those meals? And then who should I contact to learn more about becoming, in this case, example, a Medicaid provider or subcontractor? And that will help you begin to think about some of the questions that are coming up as we move through the advocacy plan. But if you can't answer those questions, you have to do more research. So the next step is determining who your advocacy targets are. And that will really depend on what you decided was in your ask. So you can think about what it is you're trying to do. If you're trying to get new legislation passed, then you probably want to target elected officials. If you're trying to get a change in Medicaid or Medicare, you're probably wanting to target agency officials, like in your health department or nationally at HHS, or sometimes depending upon, again, who you're targeting, Office of Mental Hygiene or Mental Health, depending upon how it's structured in your own state. But you need to figure out where you think the best leverage is because of what it is you're trying to accomplish. And once you know that, you'll need to figure out who within all of those agencies is the right person or are the right people to make your case to. The next step in the process is figuring out the key players as well as your coalition partners. So the key players are really important because all advocacy efforts build on relationships. Because advocacy is really just that. It is knowing the people who can take the action that you want to influence the outcome that you want, but also demonstrating to them that you are a good partner in response to that. So the advocacy targets, you know, we talked earlier, could be insurers, policymakers, providers. Your job is to make sure that they know you well and that they also understand, because you've told them, that this is a two-way street, and not only do you want something from them, but you actually have something of value that they could rely on as well. So you may be seeking a contract to provide services, but you may be offering ongoing information about the role of food and nutrition and overall health to the person that you're trying to influence. And you will be more successful the stronger your relationship is with those key players. In terms of your coalition partners, it is well known that the louder the voice, and there's lots of ways, and I don't mean you go yell at elected officials, louder in terms of numbers of people or numbers of advocates, the more you are advocating within a larger group of voices, the stronger your plea will be. So you can think about who you want as your coalition partners. And that can be other food and nutrition providers. That can be in a bigger circle of people within the food world. That might be medical personnel or hospital administrators, insurance plans, volunteers in your program, your board, your donors, and or your clients. And very often your clients are some of your very best advocates because they are the people who know best the impact of the kinds of services that you provide. So you're going to see throughout this presentation, I'm going to have a few slides that say caution, like hold on a minute. I just want to say here, your time is valuable and you could end up going down quite a long, long, distracted road trying to talk to every coalition and be in every coalition. And you're going to need to do some kind of analysis so that you can figure out for yourself and for your program what are the best relationships that you think will amplify your voice, that will help you advance your goals. Because if you just chase every single opportunity, you're probably not going to get there. So the next step in the plan is to take action. And taking action, it has a number of steps, and we'll review them each. But it starts with research and dissemination of information, which helps you with your messaging, spreading the word, meeting with people, face-to-face meetings, mobilizing other advocates potentially, and ultimately funding, getting contracts and trying to get the outcome that you're hoping to get in healthcare reform. So let's start with research and dissemination. The most important thing here is that to get people to pay you for the services that you are providing within the healthcare reform arena, you must prove that your program works and saves money and that you are the experts in delivering the food and nutrition that people need to get to the best health outcomes and the most reduced cost. And you got to have a lot of places to go look for information. You can start with your own program. You probably have client stats, program outcomes. You may do surveys. You can start with who you are. You can also then do a lot of research on studies that have been done by other researchers, whether they're academic researchers, medical researchers. Hospitals do community needs assessments. Planning councils, if you're in the HIV world, also do community assessments. And you need to pull all of that together in some digestible, number one, messages, and number two, handouts, or what we call leave-behinds, that you can, when you go and you make your case, you can leave in the office of the hospital administrator, the legislator, the insurer, the Department of Health staff member. So you need to make sure that you get your message well-crafted and in a presentable way, and that you take lots of opportunities to disseminate the food as medicine message that you have tailored to your program and your specific situation. So let's talk for just a moment about messaging. Messaging is really the way that you are going to make the case that your ask is perfectly reasonable and absolutely should get acted upon. In general, people can only remember both from the delivery perspective and also from the receiving perspective, three or four message points at a time. We are all very eager to tell people everything every time we sit down with them, and the truth is that people just don't remember that. So you need to figure out what your strongest message is, stick with that, use supporting research and client stories to hammer home your message, and always connect it to the triple aim, because that is what healthcare is focusing on. And for those of you who haven't really looked at this graphic, let me just say that the triple aim is better health outcomes, lower cost of care, and improved patient satisfaction. And you need to be able to make your message address those issues. And after every meeting, even though you think your message is perfect, sit down, evaluate, refine it, repractice it, because chances are it can get better and better every time you deliver it. So I'm going to share with you a message box. That's what we call them here, that we've used at God's Love. This is a lot of words, but I'm going to break it down pretty easily. Our key message is the big white circle in the middle that says it's about food as medicine. That's the main message, right? And we've used this with hospitals to say you must incorporate food and nutrition into post-hospital discharge care if you're going to lower readmission, lower costs, and improve quality, right? But the four messages that we want people to remember are just the bold around the circle. FNS meets the triple aim. It's low-cost, high-impact intervention. We are unique. That's a God's Love message, and we explain why. And one in three people who are hospitalized suffer from malnutrition, because that's what's driving hospital readmission. And we have used this as our four key talking points over and over again to get us to the point where people understand what we mean by food as medicine and why we are saying that our ask is to include food and nutrition in post-hospital discharge. So taking action to reach our goals. There are many different forms of action to be taken. And you have to decide which actions are appropriate for what it is you are trying to do. The first is face-to-face meetings, which can include legislative breakfast, legislative meetings in district or on the Hill, larger briefings that you host for a lot of people at the same time, events, special deliveries, which so many of us can do, in terms of taking an elected official or a departmental official on a visit to a client, and then any speeches or presentations that you might do. You can spread the word. Sometimes that's really effective to get a lot of people as your allies through social media or blogs or letters to the editor or any number of other ways of spreading the word. You can mobilize for action. You can do calls for action, letter writing campaigns, grassroots and grass top strategies. Grassroots like are people like your clients and volunteers. And grass top strategies are using sometimes people often on your board or as good for your donor base who are more strongly connected to some of the influencers in your community or in your state, either because they have supported them along their careers, or they may be personal friends, or they may be professional colleagues. And ultimately, working on a funding contract is a way of taking action, which is sometimes even harder than the other three, believe it or not. So again, a word of caution here, and that is that you must know your state's rules regarding advocacy versus lobbying. And very often those are tied to budget levels. How much of your annual budget as an organization do you spend trying to influence specific legislation or specific funding? And once you know that, you then, if you decide that you are going to go into the world of lobbying, and again, from the New York perspective, New York City, the lobby threshold is very, very low. So we have to lobby if we're going to do advocacy. We have to be registered as a lobbyist. And in that regard, we need to be able to get our board support, which we have done, and then keep very, very strong data on how much time we spend and for what purposes in trying to influence change. And so my big advice to all of you, if you're not sure what to do, is make sure you're in touch with your local Lawyers Alliance, whatever they call it in your state. But they're usually not-for-profit organizations that do a lot of these kinds of workshops. So help not-for-profits not get into trouble on this very issue. So that's an external strategy. And you can only be strong enough in this. You don't want to get out ahead of yourself. If you are successful in getting a contract, you want to make sure you can handle it. So from the internal perspective, you need to ask yourself, are you ready to make the changes that you have to make to stay up with healthcare reform? Because you're living in a world now where there is heightened consumer engagement. The people who are in healthcare plans, particularly the dually eligible or on the managed care plans, are pretty well informed and can be very vocal about what they want and what they like. Your product, meaning your meals or your food, is evaluated every day. And if people are not pleased, they let the program know that. Their insurance company or who's ever paying for the product know that. And there are many different customers to please. You have your clients, of course, first and foremost, but the health plans and the hospitals and the state regulators. As soon as you move into Medicaid or Medicare, you have many, many people that are going to be looking at the outcome of your program. And the last piece is that there's greater volatility. People change, clients change their programs all the time. They move from one Medicaid Advantage plan to another or one MCO to another. And there's a lot of work to keep track of who is going to be reimbursing you for whose meals. So the first thing you need to do, though, before you jump into worrying about some of those issues, is to really make sure that whatever you are trying to achieve through your advocacy plan, let's say contracts for third-party reimbursement, is consistent with your mission, and that your board and staff and volunteers understand why you're doing this and that they are willing to work with you on getting you there and helping you be successful. Because without those things, you will spend an awful lot of internal time constantly fighting that battle. Next. So, again, here's a message box that we have used successfully at God's Love around third-party reimbursement. And the most important part here, again, it's only four messages. Our key message is that third-party reimbursement is essential for food and nutrition services programs. And we continue to drive home that clients pay zero for their meals, that funding is just another source of public funding, like for us, Ryan White, which is a source of public funding that we get, that diversified funding makes programs stronger, and that the services we provide under third-party reimbursement are consistent with our mission of serving people living with severe illness. And we have used this regularly and often And most, I would say that all of the resistance that we have had to being part of third-party reimbursement contracts has dissipated. So you've checked, you're together with your mission, and now you need to get more into the nuts and bolts of what it means from an administrative point of view. Do you have the resources to do the contracting that you need to do? And if not, who will you engage from the outside, and how will you pay for it? And most especially that you know the unit cost per meal or per whatever it is you're trying to get into that contract, whether that's a counseling session, a nutrition session, whatever it may be, because that is the most important thing to your long-term survival. If you underprice it, you're going to be in a deficit, and if you overprice it, you're not going to get the contract. Then you need to think about your program delivery model and how flexible you are willing to be now and over time. Can you, for instance, if you're a delivery program, deliver on different days? Can you add more or fewer components? Can you staff up to do the kind of communication that the plans want, like wanting to know every day who's not at home if somebody misses a meal? Then when you look at the billing issues, that's a really hard thing to do because most of us are from programs that don't bill. We offer our services in large measure for free or for almost free, depending upon the program. So are you able to ramp up and do billing to Medicaid or Medicare? Are you able to deal with the medical terminology, CPT codes, ICD-10 codes? And if you're not able to do those things, can you find the resources to purchase the software you need and or to get the expert advice to help you figure out even what it is that you need? And then on the finance side, you need to find out if you have, again, staff in place to execute the billing. It's one thing to have software. It's another thing to have the people in your program who can figure out who to bill, how much, for when. And then if you're being asked to expand, because so much of Medicare or Medicaid is statewide, not just local, do you have the ability to do that? And finally, do you have the systems and the technology for all the data collection, retrieval, and reporting that is required, either for the lobbying, for the plan, for the hospital, and or for any research? And then lastly, I just want to say that advocacy is never done. So this is back to the full graphic. When you do all of this, which, again, I just want to say is not an overnight thing. It takes time. But you are constantly in a feedback loop, partly because you can always get better and better and better at it, but also because the landscape of healthcare reform continues to change. And you need to ask yourself whether or not you are ready and able to meet the next challenge that is coming your way. And so I'm going to stop by just saying make sure that you celebrate your success. Advocacy is sort of taking little roadblocks and keep stacking them up. Tell your stories everywhere. Celebrate the good news. Even if you're not at your big goal, you might be at you might have hit some important marker along the way. And take a breath, celebrate your success, because there will always be more work to be done in the world of advocacy. But it's always easier to do it from the point of success than it is to do it feeling beleaguered, like there's such a long road ahead. So take it in chunks and celebrate as you get there. Okay, so Sarah, is there anything you want to add right now, or should we jump to questions?
No, I think we should just jump to questions.
Okay.
But I asked them. So this question is from Pam Almeida, and she asks, if your state does not have a waiver, who do you advocate with in order to change that?
I'll take a stab at it, but Sarah, you can probably jump in more. But I think that goes back to doing the research in your own state about how does Medicaid, who administers Medicaid in your own state, and to think about how you might then get in. Obviously, we all want to get in at the top. So at New York State, again, that's the director of Medicaid, who we have now had many meetings with. But I will tell you, we must have had 2 years of meeting probably 15 different people along the pathway to the director's office. So you need to get started. Very often it is helpful to work with either a coalition that has some of those relationships or with an advocacy firm that has those relationships, because they can sometimes get the door open when you can't. But you need to figure out how Medicaid decisions get made in your state, and therefore to target who might be the point of influence.
Right, and I would just add that occasionally meeting with your state legislators who are on the Health and Human Services Committee or whatever committee it is in your state that is thinking about Medicaid, they are good people to meet with, because sometimes a nudge from the state legislators can encourage your Medicaid program to do something that it might have been thinking about but maybe wasn't doing. And it doesn't have to be, you know, the introduction of a bill, but sometimes just communication between those two bodies can be helpful.
And I guess I'll add just one other thing, Sarah, and tell me if you agree with this, but there's also, now that the ACA has been out for a while, and it's clear based on the Supreme Court that it will continue to be, there are many coalitions in states that do not have Medicaid expansion who are working on it from lots of different perspectives. There are some who are from the economic perspective, because Medicaid expansion comes with a lot of federal dollars, so it is good for the economy. There are some from the not-for-profit community that say, you know, this ought to be available to people who are poor, and therefore we need to do it. There are many. So spend some time talking with other not-for-profits in your community, and I would suspect you would find one of those coalitions that perhaps you can join their efforts. And again, that goes to the amplification of your voice. If you do it in a larger coalition, it really might, you might get there faster than doing it by yourself.
I completely agree.
So next question from Tony Bruno. Where do I find out more about the Medicare Advantage opportunity for Arizona?
So I'll jump in about this one. So this is a new opportunity. It's very new, just announced in September. And so what you're going to want to do if you're in one of those states that I talked about, and those states were, I believe, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Indiana, Tennessee, Iowa, Oregon, and Arizona, then you're going to want to think about which Medicare Advantage plans are offered in your state and try to think about what kinds of relationships you might have or be able to leverage with those plans, insurers that administer those plans, because you're going to want to start talking to those folks now. And they're going to be applying to CMS to take advantage of this this new model, and those applications are due in January of 2016. So you're going to want to start laying the groundwork by figuring out who they are and trying to get meetings with them. And CMS will be releasing a lot more guidance on this insurance model, and there's a contact person and a webinar available on the CMMI website. So if you go to innovation.cms.gov, you can take a look at this insurance, the value-based insurance design model, and you can get a lot of more information there.
Pam, I'm just going to go back to the question before for a moment, because I did not realize that you asked specifically about waivers. I apologize for that. I can't quite see the questions from where I'm sitting. I just wanted to say a couple of different things. One is to everybody first, which is that in the toolkit there are links to all the different kinds of waivers and programs so that you can figure out how to go find out what your state has. Second, I just wanted to say to the specifics of Pam's question that every state except for five, I think it is, have 1915C waivers, which are the home and community-based waivers. So waivers don't waivers cover can cover any number of different benefits, meals being just one option. So you first have to find out whether your state has a waiver that already covers meals. If not, because they already have a waiver, sometimes states are kind of perennially working on waivers, and there may be an opportunity for you to influence the next waiver. And then I would say the same thing about 1115 waivers, so that there's opportunities for you to either determine that your state has what you want, and a lot of people don't even know that they might, but also then to influence them happening. So the five states that do not have waivers are Arizona, Nevada, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, and Vermont. So I don't know who's on from those states, but you might have a longer stretch, longer fight to try to get a waiver. But for most states, there's a vehicle in place that could either already work or might be amended.
Okay, I think we answered the question about sending around the slides. I encourage you all to please continue to ask us questions, so we'll move on to the next one. Alexandra asked, are diet supplements like Ensure and Glycerna covered by Medicaid and or Medicare? Sarah, do you want to take a stab at that?
I'll take a stab at it. So I'm not entirely sure about the ins and outs of coverage for those supplements by Medicaid or Medicare. I know that in situations where there are enteral feeding programs in place, then Ensure and Glycerna can be covered as one of the supplements that they can use in those cases. But I'm not sure about coverage in those for Medicaid.
Right, and I'm
just not sure.
Right, and Sarah, just to build on that a little bit, I know that there are some waivers for HIV services where some of those supplements are covered. That's mostly federal through Ryan White. But at the state level, there are also many, many states will cover some of the supplements, but they're very often focused on particular diseases. So, again, that's part of the research that you need to do statewide. I mean, in your own state.
So this is just a note from Caitlin at Mana. That another option for states without waivers is to partner with a managed care organization, which is generally how Medicaid is increasingly being organized, which means it's no longer a fee-for-service payment, but plans are administering the insurance through their vehicle rather than the state directly. So you can also explore contracting with a plan directly as part of their per-member-per-month payment structure. So many hospitals have the same incentive through Medicare because they're getting penalized for rehospitalizations. So exploring that on a per-contract basis is also helpful. By the way, my name is Alyssa Wasung, and I'm the Director of Policy and Planning, and I work with Karen at God's Love. So I've become the MC for today's Q&A. The next
Before you jump off, so I think that's a really important point from Caitlin. And I will just tell you an anecdote, which is when we were talking with a number of the managed care companies here in New York, the head of Medicaid and the Department of Health said to them, you know, if you all think that it's helpful to buy everybody air conditioning because that will help them stay in their house all summer rather than get hospitalized because they're dehydrated, go buy them air conditioners. So once you get to the per member per month model, the managed care organizations can support whatever they think is the right thing to keep their members at home and out of the hospital. So that's where your research becomes ever more important, because if you can demonstrate that your program is an effective program for doing just that, that will, and that's not just saying we believe it, or that's not just saying one person's testimony. That's a research project probably more than anything, but at least enough of data collection that can at least make that case, even if it's not the most scientifically pure research. You might have a case of getting them to really be more open to using some of their precious per member per month money because they can understand that in the long run it will save the plan a great deal of money because hospitalization is just so much more expensive than feeding people.
All right, the next question is from Bertha Hurd. When we receive the toolkit, will we have an opportunity to email the presenters for additional questions as an excellent resource? And if that is the case, will emails be forthcoming?
So yes. How's that?
We're actually about to enter all that information into the chat box. Sarah's email and Karen's email is that's the best way to reach them. So we'll do that presently. I just want to make sure that no one else has any questions because I don't see any more. Ah, wait a second. 1 second. Here we go. A question just came in. Thank you so much, Edwin. How do you make the case about long-term health outcomes with hospital health plans that have 12-month contracts?
I'm not sure I understand.
So what I think we might do is shall I unmute? I'm going to unmute the phone. If you all can please not put your phones on hold for the remainder of this webinar because it often interrupts the webinar with music, I am going to unmute you all to allow Edwin to elaborate and to allow anyone else to answer questions or ask questions verbally.
The conference has been unmuted.
All right. Edwin, if you are still on, would you like to elaborate on your question?
Oh, so you're already down.
Okay, all right, cool. We can hear everybody now. So if you're in an office talking to other people, mute your own line.
All right,
hi everyone. You're good to go.
What else am I?
Okay, wait, folks. Is everybody to go? We can hear you.
One other suggestion I would make is that you do this every day.
Okay, so
you post it every day.
And then it reposts.
But tomorrow,
I think we need to mute. Edwin, could you please elaborate on your question in the chat box?
Yes, I was wondering what kind of
the conference has been muted.
Sorry about that, Edwin. Can you just write us another moment what you mean about 12-month contracts?
And in the meantime, I can actually spell the emails. I will send the contact information with the slides. That's the best way to do it so it's clear to everybody. I don't know what Edwin's elaboration will be, but we did just get another question. Is there a list of established coalitions that already exist regarding food as medicine?
There is the Food as Medicine Coalition, which we meet by phone every month, and we can include that as well when we send this out. And so we're happy that other people will join us, and we continue to have these conversations. And the Food as Medicine Coalition really is focusing on people. It's kind of where the toolkit is focused on medically tailored meals for people who are living with severely chronic illnesses. So that's really the focus that we look at. Other than that, I would suggest that there are a number of Meals on Wheels providers here. Obviously, you yourselves, I believe, are a coalition who work on some of these issues together, and that's probably another good resource for many of the programs who have dialed in today.
All right. So, Edwin, thank you so much for elaborating. What he is asking is, how do you make the case about long-term health outcomes if hospitals and health plans have an only 12-month contract, which means, like, what kind of arguments could be effective to convince hospitals and health plans to invest in long-term health outcomes when they're only interested in the short term?
Now I get it. Sarah, do you want to take that or do you want me to jump in?
Oh, sorry. Hold on. I need to unmute Sarah. Go ahead, Sarah. You're good to go now.
Okay. I can jump in, and then Karen can also contribute mm-hmm. as well. So when you're making the case, especially for hospitals, I mean, these folks, even if they have 12-month contracts, hospitals are going to be seeing the folks that are in their service areas for as long as they're in those areas. So they have a lot of investment and incentives because they are going to continue to be subject to Medicare readmission penalties. So they're going to have a lot of interest in trying to reduce readmissions among anybody who's coming through their hospital doors. And then from a health plan perspective, it is true that there's a lot of cycling that happens between different insurance plans. And so trying to make the case that, you know, you may get this person back later on and they're going to benefit from having had this service up front. And that the fact that even though the folks that you're going to have receiving medically tailored meals are folks that they are already in some state health-wise, that means that they are likely to have high health needs within that 12-month period. So long-term health outcomes absolutely are a part of medically tailored meals, but short-term health outcomes are also a big part of it as well.
I would agree with everything that Sarah said, and I would just add the one piece, which is that, at least to our knowledge, I can't think of any insurance program or MCO that is willing to feed people just because it's better for them in the long run. So they are very interested in, as she said, short-term outcomes, but really short-term outcomes that turn around severe illness states and or that address a particularly bad period in a chronic illness state. But in general, health insurance programs are not interested in maintaining people on a food program for a very long time. They are looking more short-term and more interventionist, if I might use that as an expression. And one other piece that I will just add is that in the long run, it is to the insurance company, the hospitals, the MCO's interest to have people who are in a better health position and who are more stabilized from a nourishment position, because otherwise those people will be the ones who cycle in and out of hospitals, and I think they know that. So, but again, that's usually intervention, food and nutrition services for people who are really suffering with some very serious illnesses, and the lack of food will make it, you know, pretty clear that they will become malnourished and probably in much greater medical danger.
Okay, so I don't see any more questions. I just want to give everyone one last opportunity to type in any questions that you have. So we will wait for just a second longer to see if there's anything entered. I hesitate to unmute the phone given our last venture, but thank you all for that. Oh, we did get one more. From Dr. Drina Valentine, we are constantly being asked from medical service providers, other organizations, and contracted services to increase the number of individuals we serve. Has God's Love We Deliver included advocacy funds in their funding or grant requests?
Yes, we have. And I would say not necessarily to the same groups. So the people who are asking us to expand our services to serve more people are not necessarily the ones who also fund advocacy. So it's that is a complicated funding question, and we have made the decision to make part of our ongoing budget focus on advocacy, because ultimately we believe that without good advocacy, there will be no program in the long run, because everything that we do, even if it is not necessarily government advocacy, is really telling our story and sharing our messages and ensuring that we are making the case to everybody who supports us that what we do is effective and really adds to the quality of life for the people who we serve. So, yeah, advocacy is an important part of our budget.
And this is Alyssa just hopping in on that question. I want to say I think that increasing the number of members you serve is far less an advocacy question than an infrastructure question and an efficiency question. can your existing program model actually handle increasing those numbers? So I would say that's more of an internal organizational mission perspective. All that internal assessment that Karen spent time on, that's where those questions really lie. And so I think that has to do with the capacity of your board and the capacity of your own program to absorb some of these increased workloads, et cetera. All right, let me just see if there are any more questions. I don't see any more. All right. I think that brings us to the end of the Q&A portion. Thank you to everybody who submitted questions. Again, I just want to say from the admin side before I hand it back to Karen and Sarah, we will be circulating both the white paper, the toolkit, and the slide. So I guess it's not a both, it's an all, at the end of the week, as well as the contact information for our presenters. So thank you all so much for being on this webinar. Here's Karen and Sarah.
I, too, just want to express my thanks to all of you for joining us and for demonstrating your interest in food as medicine and the advocacy that goes along to making that real, and that helps us all move closer and closer to getting part and parcel of the healthcare reform efforts across the country. Sarah?
And this is Sarah, and I just want to say thank you so much, especially for bearing with us on all of the very complicated terminology that we threw at you during this webinar and continue to throw at you as you continue to listen to us about what opportunities might be out there. And we are available, of course, for any clarifying questions that come up.
Thank you all.